It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here as we look at a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. It reveals 3 out of 10 Wisconsinites over age 21 live within a 1-hour drive from a legally operating recreational marijuana dispensary across state lines. So we examine consumption, sales, tax revenue data from neighboring states with your questions along the way about the report's findings on access to cannabis in the upper Midwest. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ari Brown is a senior research associate with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Ari, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
So recreational marijuana being legal in Illinois and Michigan, and we see Minnesota moving in that direction with lawmakers trying to push that through this session. Are Wisconsin residents buying marijuana out of state?
Yeah, so I think that this is the question that really motivated us to do this research. It's hard to know for sure. We don't have data comprehensively from all of those states. But we do know that Illinois tracks data from out-of-state sales overall. So that would include anyone from any state besides Illinois. And in every month since about June 2020, about 6 months into their legalization effort, every month since then, anywhere between 25 and 35% of all sales in Illinois has gone to out-of-state residents. We note in our report that Madison and Milwaukee are really two of the largest cities that are close to a border with Illinois in terms of the states that don't have legal recreational marijuana at this point in time. So there's definitely, a high likelihood that a large percentage of those sales in Illinois are going to Wisconsin residents.
Do you see, when you look at the mapping, does it look like there is a thriving business model that hugs state lines in those states to capture those customers across a border?
Yeah, so that was one of the things that we also looked very closely at, was where exactly are these dispensaries located? I think that the two that really stood out to us were both in Illinois. One was in East Dubuque, Illinois, which is kind of on that border of Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois, where all three states converge. The other was in South Beloit, obviously right next to Beloit, Wisconsin. Both of these dispensaries were less than a mile from the Wisconsin border. Really, you could be living in Wisconsin in a city right on the other side of the border and walk to these dispensaries. They were that close. So I think those two really stood out to us. There are also a number in kind of the north suburbs of Chicago that would be closer to the Milwaukee area. And then when you look at Michigan, obviously that area of Wisconsin that hugs the Michigan border is a little bit like less sparsely, more sparsely populated, fewer individuals living there. There are a number of dispensaries that are not far across the Michigan borderline as well.
Do you find that Michigan crunches numbers differently than Illinois when you gather your data to look at the impact of out-of-state purchases?
Yeah, so in terms of marijuana legalization in Michigan, there are no differing possession limits, whether you come from in-state or out-of-state. So they don't necessarily track who they're selling to. Illinois, the possession limits differ. So if you're an out-of-state resident who is purchasing marijuana in Illinois, you can only possess half the amount that they specify in state law. So because of that, Illinois actually needs to track who they're selling to. You would go to an Illinois dispensary and show an ID, and then they would determine, this is how much we're able to legally sell you. So because of that, they're able to track much more specifically what percentage of sales are going to, residents of Illinois versus residents of other states.
I'm going to reintroduce you here, Ari Brown of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, researcher looking at marijuana policy in Wisconsin and the impact from neighboring states and dispensaries there along the Illinois and Michigan border. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Ari, how is Wisconsin responding to out-of-state marijuana purchases?
I think this is another great question. This kind of legislation is something that we've seen debated pretty vigorously in Wisconsin over the last 5 to 10 years or so. You've had in each kind of legislative session, you've had certainly Democrats proposing, a number of bills, both in the state budget proposed by the governor 2 years ago and the state budget proposed by the governor just a few weeks ago. You saw efforts to legalize both medical and recreational marijuana. I think on the other side, certainly from Republican leaders, you've seen contemplation of this topic, more so when it comes to medical marijuana. There has not been a lot of momentum behind recreational marijuana from the Republican caucus in either the Senate or the Assembly thus far. But certainly towards the beginning of the year this year, we saw, items from both Leader LeMahieu in the state Senate and Speaker Voss in the Assembly mentioning how their caucuses were talking about medical marijuana. That said, it seems unlikely right now that either of the governor's proposals for medical or recreational would be accepted by the state legislature. Those are unlikely to pass right now. I think, go ahead.
I'm going to just jump in here because it seems like there have been some mixed messages from Republicans. I mean, last month, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said on our show that he favors partial legalization of marijuana.
I support a form of medical marijuana where it is very restricted. So it's only going to folks who have a true medical condition in a way that guarantees that we don't have any kind of, being taken advantage of.
But then, later in January, Voss walked that back, telling WISN-TV, said, we're not that close on legalizing medical marijuana. What are policy sticking points among Assembly and Senate Republican when it comes to medicinal marijuana?
Yeah, so I think you heard Speaker Voss mention a couple of them there. I think one of them is what qualifies as medical usage. You have states where, you don't have to have a certain condition to qualify. It would really just be up to the discretion of the doctor. You have other states that are very specific in terms of you need to have one of these specific medical conditions in order to qualify. Other items that would be important in writing a medical law are whether or not there would be a registry, how that would work, would you need to pay to be on a registry? Can medical marijuana be grown at home? And if so, what do the regulations for that look like? How are dispensaries set up? If we're looking at medical marijuana, do you have one dispensary? Do you have a dozen, a couple hundred? That really determines, that's a really big sticking point. And then is medical marijuana taxed at all? Is another big sticking point. What state agency is in charge? So there's a lot of rules and regulations here to consider. And it sounds like these are all things that the Republican caucus is considering and debating before they come forward with any sort of proposal.
It seems like you're bringing up here a lot of moving pieces and parts when you're looking at rules and regulations and what would need to be set up. Let's say a bill does pass. How soon would Wisconsin residents likely gain access to medical marijuana?
Yeah, this is a great question. And we've seen states that have already gone through this process differ very heavily. It could be set up within something like 6 to 9 months. It could also take a couple of years. You have states that have legalized marijuana for even recreational purposes that are yet to have a dispensary open. It's been a number of years. So it really all depends on the regulatory process here and what that looks like and what is written into state law.
Ari Brown is a senior research associate with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, out with a new report citing data and lessons learned from neighboring states where cannabis is legal. Be part of the conversation by calling in with your questions about marijuana. Share how you think legalization would change or not change our state. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We break down a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum that finds half of adults 21 or older in our state live within 75-minute drive from an out-of-state cannabis retailer, like, say, in Michigan or Illinois. Call in with your questions about proximity to marijuana, what you want state lawmakers to do on this. 800-642-1234. Wisconsin Policy Forum Senior Research Associate Ari Brown stays with us. Ari, let's take a look at city ordinances now. Cities like Eau Claire and Oshkosh, Milwaukee, Madison have these ordinances in place to eliminate the penalties for carrying smaller amounts of marijuana. Like in Madison, people may carry up to 28 grams of marijuana. Why are Wisconsin cities decriminalizing it?
Yeah, so this is definitely something that we've seen pick up over the last 5 to 10 years or so. Though certainly there were places in the state that had considered it beforehand. But this has really been a push at the very local level, you know, usually by local legislators saying, hey, you know, this is not something that makes our community better. We feel like this is, you know, unfairly policing certain items, and we want to have a decriminalization law on the books. So you mentioned a number of them there. You have places like Milwaukee County and Eau Claire, where there isn't necessarily full decriminalization, but you have fines at the local level being brought all the way down to $1. So just kind of recognition of the same kind of law. This, of course, wouldn't include state court costs and other items. So, you know, the overall cost for some sort of possession charge would still be higher than $1 or higher than $0. But certainly places like Madison, too, are, you know, have full decriminalization in place where you can carry and even consume cannabis in, certain parts of the city. So it ends up leading to a fairly confusing policy picture where you have state law and federal law that prohibits the possession and consumption of the substance, but then local law that treats it very differently.
Yeah, and I just wonder, do these bottom-up approach perhaps, or do these ordinances apply pressure at the state level then to make a change?
It's hard to know. You know, we've had certain places in the state that have had these laws in place for a while, and and we haven't seen that change from the state. That said, you know, as more and more cities consider this, and you know, as more and more places around the state have, you know, years of experience having decriminalization, it's certainly something that we could see happen over time.
I wonder if residents even understand the limits of municipal and community ordinances versus state law.
Yeah, I think it's a an incredibly confusing policy picture. You know, for example, Madison is a city that has a decriminalization law, but Milwaukee County has one. So you're looking at the city versus the county. The borders here are not always well understood. So you could cross a municipal border even within Wisconsin, and the laws even at the local level are very different. Of course, you have a lot of Wisconsin's population, as we note, that lives very close to the Illinois border, where, you know, the state law then changes, you know, between areas that are very heavily populated. So it's a really confusing kind of set of policy at the local versus the state level.
Let's turn to, well, actually, Sally from Oshkosh called and wants to join in here, thinks legal recreational marijuana will just never happen in Wisconsin. And Sally says this is because of lobbying from taverns and bars. Tavern lobby organizations want marijuana to stay illegal. What might be going on there? What are your insights?
Yeah, so this is definitely something that you see as part of the conversation, especially in a state like Wisconsin, where you have, you know, such a thriving industry around alcohol. You know, I think that it's something definitely to take into consideration. There are studies that show that over a certain age, a fairly young age, that marijuana and alcohol tend to be substitute products. So in general, the more consumption of marijuana you have, the less alcohol consumption you have. That's certainly, I would imagine, a concern for lobbying groups. That said, you know, I think it's something that we may see evolve over time. Certainly states that have legalized marijuana for recreational purposes have not lost their alcohol industries. You know, indeed, over the last few years, certainly since the pandemic, we've generally seen alcohol consumption increase throughout the U.S. So I think it's something interesting to consider, and definitely not a small part of the picture in Wisconsin, but certainly not something that I would imagine would prohibit it, you know, years and years into the future.
However, it does get complicated, I would imagine, under rules and regulations heading. I mean, how do states handle THC beverages and, lower potency edibles as part of their legalization?
Certainly, I think this is such a complicated part of the picture. You know, you have very few states that even take that into consideration when it comes to taxation. Illinois would be a big one. Illinois taxes marijuana differently based on the potency level. So above or below 35% THC, there are different levels of an excise tax. But yeah, I think this is something that, you know, just because of the nature of marijuana legalization right now, it's very broken up. It's very different at each state. And then you have states where it's not legal at all. And I think, you know, certain states have had, you know, most states that have legalized have had a difficult time regulating, you know, the products that that marijuana is are a part of change all the time. And you mentioned marijuana beverages. That wasn't even a thing a couple of years ago. So I think that the regulatory picture here is something that is really interesting and a really important part of this.
Ari Brown is with us, Senior Research Associate with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, as we talk about the state of marijuana policy in Wisconsin. Compared to our neighboring states, Illinois and Michigan, where recreational marijuana is legal, call in with your thoughts and questions, 800-642-1234. Audrey is with us from Eau Claire. Good morning, Audrey. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to comment on the county ordinances. I live in Eau Claire County, where people think that marijuana was decriminalized, but there's a lot of misunderstanding about what that actually means, and people will get charged with a misdemeanor and be expected to go to court, and they think that marijuana was decriminalized within the city, so they're confused about what actually happened. Thank you.
Audrey, thank you so much. I mean, there, Ari, is an example of that confusion.
Yeah, I mean, I think what a perfect example. You know, it is hard to track local legislation, I think, you know, especially when laws change so frequently. You know, you may see a story in the news about how, you know, a local city council took a vote on something. And I just don't think there's always that understanding there of, okay, what are our laws at the current moment? And depending on where I live, what are the laws? You know, where are the boundaries between the city of Eau Claire and the rest of Eau Claire County? I just think it's something that's not well understood. And when you have legislation at the local level that is so piecemeal as it is in Wisconsin, certainly you're seeing policy outcomes that like Audrey mentioned, where it's just very confusing what the laws are depending on where you are.
Can you walk us through some tax revenue and that aspect that you added up in your data, and what could Wisconsin learn from Michigan and Illinois there in taxation?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. So in terms of taxation, there are a number of different taxes you could levy on the purchase of medical or recreational marijuana, primarily recreational marijuana. So you could levy an excise tax, which is kind of a sales tax on a product that recognizes that there are negative externalities associated with it. So it's usually a little bit higher. There's a gross receipts tax that Illinois levies. That's a tax on the producer that is usually reflected in the purchase price. I think another question that states are considering are, do local governments get to levy a tax? What are the levels of tax? So that's a really important item. And then on the other side, the revenue. So what does the revenue that marijuana generates go to?
Yes.
So in Michigan, you see their marijuana program ends up donating some revenue to local governments, to K-12 education, and to transportation. In Illinois, those items, as well as things like drug treatment, a community services fund, a budget stabilization fund, restorative justice programs that kind of deal with the past harms that were created by the prohibition of marijuana, at least that's how their state law recognizes it. So there are so many different items here involved in the taxation picture, and it really looks different depending on what state you're in. So I think that's something really interesting for Wisconsin to consider in the future.
Is the taxation picture in Wisconsin figured out in any way? Are there any projections or estimates how much revenue could be collected here?
Yeah, so in the governor's budget, his proposal does have a projection. If I remember correctly, it's fairly low. It would be less than $10 million in the first couple of years. And this is typically something that we see, that marijuana recreational marijuana legalization takes a few years to get up to kind of the full effect in terms of tax revenue. But I think it's just really hard to know without all of these individual items figured out. Just to, you know, cite one example, Illinois' tax structure for marijuana is incredibly complex. They have a number of different taxes that all go to different places. So I think that's something that would need to be figured out in Wisconsin first, and then you need to figure out all of the other kind of rules and regulations around it. But certainly it would take a few years to get up to kind of full effect in terms of total revenue.
Ari, thank you for joining us and sharing this report.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Ari Brown is a senior research associate at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We have a link to the report called Changing Midwest Marijuana Landscape Impacts Wisconsin. It's at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to an audience question about some mysterious trains.
Just off a highway in northwest Wisconsin's Washburn County sits a long string of parked rail cars of different shapes and sizes. A listener who regularly passes these rail cars was curious about them, so she reached out to Wisconsin to figure out why they are there. WPR's Andrea Anderson took a road trip to find the answer.
If you're driving north along Highway 53 between Spooner and Trigo, you'll see a long line of rail cars parked on tracks on your right. The line of different cars seems like it will never end. Mary Kay Lovejoy passes these rail cars on the way to her cabin in Bayfield County, and she's always wondered why they're parked here.
You know, I always wondered, do these move? Are they just here in storage? And then I got curious, well, are they related to the frac sand mining? Why are they there all the time?
The question led me to Greg Vreeland. He is the general manager of the Wisconsin Great Northern Railroad, a company that operates on the tracks where the mysterious rail cars are parked. Vreeland says a couple things determine if a rail car is moving from place to place: the global economy and what commodities are in demand.
At various points of the year, railroad cars of specific types become surplus to the needs of the shipping community. When there are extra cars that need a place to park, the railroads and the owners of the cars work with the small, what they call short line railroads, to use extra pieces of track that are not being used for another purpose to store the cars on.
Vreeland leases 26 miles of tracks from the state of Wisconsin and Canadian National Railway. Some of the rail is used for scenic train rides his business runs. But the rail cars Lovejoy was curious about, those are parked on another portion of these leased tracks. Vreeland says there are close to 500 rail cars from companies around the world parked on a 6-mile portion of track. Most haul frac sand and have been sitting here for 1 to 3 years.
The frac sand market is currently depressed, so there's not the need for the number of cars that there was a few years ago. So consequently, there are a few hundred frac sand cars currently parked.
So to be honest, I'm a lot like Lovejoy. I've seen rail cars parked here many times as I travel to family cabins up north. And I've always wondered why they sit here. The tracks run nearly right alongside the highway, and the vehicle traffic is loud. Vreeland met me here to check out the line of rail cars. It looks even longer up close, and the cars are huge. Some have graffiti and look weathered, others appear new. And as he points out, some rail cars are round and others look like a rectangle.
The small cars, the short cars, are frac sand cars.
Regardless of what shape they take, rail cars are expensive to build. Their lifespan lasts decades. When they aren't being used, they're parked because it's more economical to store them until they're needed rather than scrap them. And companies try to place rail cars close to where they will be used. But finding storage can be difficult.
There are various times when a lot of cars need to be stored, you know, when we have a recession or a downturn. Unfortunately, storage becomes very, very short supply, and then cars, wherever they can find a place, they get stuck.
The economy also drives how often a rail car is pulled from the string. Vreeland staff could do it a few times a year or a few times a week.
Frac sand could be really big 2 months from now. You just never know. And if that happens, the phone will just ring off the hook. It's like, we need our cars back.
For now, the rail cars will sit here, waiting for the day they're needed to move goods from one place to another.
WPR's Andrea Anderson brought us that story on the sitting rail cars in Spooner. And that story idea came from a listener as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and now we reflect on the powerful earthquakes that have killed tens of thousands of people in Turkey and Syria this month. As survivors in the region, they fear for their lives in ruined cities with aftershocks. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Emre Bozer is a graduate student at UW-Madison and a member of the Madison Association of Turkish Students. Emre, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
How are your family and friends in Turkey doing after the quakes?
Physically, my family lives in the north part of Turkey, so I can say they are safe physically, but like emotionally and mostly like psychologically, everybody has been affected by the disaster. My friends, I have a couple of friends living in the destructed area. Some of them just left for their hometown. Some of them just cannot because the area is their hometown. I have a lot of friends who've been severely affected by the earthquakes.
Some of us, myself included, only know Turkey through what we know of the capital, Istanbul, a megacity. Can you talk about the cities that have been hit and bring us closer to them and what they're like, what they're known for?
Yeah, so the capital is Ankara in the middle of Turkey. Istanbul is like a major city. It's a big city, the biggest city. But neither Istanbul or Ankara, like not affected by the, like physically not affected by the earthquakes. So this is, we can say the southeastern part of Turkey, we can say like physically destructed. We can talk about 6 or 11 cities that have been destructed and also have like a lot of people died because of the earthquake. So this is especially the city I can speak for is Hatay. It has pretty much like the historic value. It is also known as the home of the civilizations, and pretty much multicultural and multilingual. And the many buildings and also like people's histories have been destructed there. So I'm so sorry for that.
What do your friends do there, and what is their livelihood in those cities that have been ruined?
I've been in a constant contact with my friends since it happened. So what I can say is most of them still live in tents, and then they can't go back in their homes because either they're, you know, basically collapsed, or even though let's say their building still stand, they're not sure if they're like safe to go in. So they're still waiting for the authorities to just make sure like they confirm those are actual like livable buildings. So life there, I guess the hygiene and access to, let's say, very basic human rights, including like toilets, including like food, has been a problem still. This is like the third week of the earthquake, but there are still problems that we might not think a problem, like from far away, but actually food and hygiene and also security is still a big problem in that area.
If they're living in tents, I mean, they have to find food and water and toiletries elsewhere. Are there any those types of sheltering areas nearby?
As far as I know, again, I can't speak for like each and every city, because we can say like 10 or 11 cities have been destructed, I guess. But like the ones that I can get some information from, I can say through donations and like from the NGOs and governments, you know, efforts, we have some places to, you know, get food from, get those like any items from, but still we can't say it is enough, because I think it's going to be the help needed for this area is going to be in for an extended period of time, because many of the cities, people talk about, let's say 75-80% of the building collapsed, meaning it looks like a big failed construction area, you know, like it's not safe, not clean, and also it's like impossible to get like many of the most needed like human rights. So it's a big disaster.
It seems everyone has their phones close by or is on a phone. How long was it before you were able to get in touch with your loved ones to learn that they were okay?
Surprisingly, it was really quick.
Huh.
So, you know, the first earthquake, yeah, I just want to talk about that as well. Like, it's not just a single earthquake, but for now, let me just say, the first big earthquake, which is 7.8 magnitude, occurred in Turkey time, 4:17 a.m. So like it's early in the morning, you know, like usually people sleep in that time. So it was in Wisconsin time, something like 7 p.m. or something. So I was having dinner with my like with my wife in our home. So I just got an email, not an email, a WhatsApp message on my smartphone. And so it was saying Marash 7.4. So Marash is one of the cities. And then, yeah, so I don't have any friends in Marash. So what's the deal with that? And then what is this 7.4? I just checked on the computer and I saw the earthquakes. And then the message actually came from one of my friends, actually, so living in Antakya, in Hatay, one of the most destructed cities. So she sent a couple of messages. Also, another friend of mine in the same WhatsApp group said like, I'm safe. The other said, I'm safe, but they're not sure if the, you know, house is about to collapse or even collapsed. They are just one of the, you know, like one of the floors they still stand. So it was almost a couple of minutes later that the disaster happened.
Wow. And you were starting to able to piece it together from far away. Emre Bozer, a doctoral student studying multilingualism at UW-Madison, member of the Madison Association of Turkish Students. Still time to bring up your questions about these quakes, your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Wisconsin voice draws us closer to the disaster in southeastern Turkey along the Syrian border, devastated by twin earthquakes this month and bracing for more aftershocks. Call in with your questions about the quakes, how to help survivors, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. UW-Madison doctoral student Emre Bozer is from Turkey and is sharing his story. Emre, you've been helping send supplies to Turkey through your work with the Madison Association of Turkish Students. What have you been able to supply?
Mostly the first 2 weeks. I mean, what we try to gather donations in the first week and now kind of differs because of like the, you know, the most needed things may change. So the thing is, We got a lot of clothing. We got a lot of hygiene items, a lot of like baby items. And now we've been expecting mostly like tents, blankets, sleeping bags that can be used in the longer term. Yeah, especially heaters. So these are mostly the things that we're trying to gather for now.
How have you gotten the supplies there?
So the day it happened, I think we tried to, you know, get together both physically and emotionally as like Turkish community in Madison. So within 26 hours, actually, we just got together and then sent our first truck to Chicago, the embassy, so that the truck can actually go to the most needed areas in Turkey. So it just started with a simple email, and then people just contributed, not just Turkish people, but also American people, also international community in Madison. So it started with just a simple email, and then people just started helping us out.
Do you know what items are most in need right now?
Yeah, most in need items are not clothing, I guess, but it is also on our like Twitter and Instagram. If for people like who might consider donating, should check. It's always like changing. It is like tents, blankets, sleeping bags, mats, and camp beds, let's say. So these are like generators, heaters, like portable shelters if possible. So the items can be kind of like used as in a shelter and then used for like protection in the long run.
I was reading about the role of lentil soup and tea in feeding survivors and shelters, and what is considered comforting to survivors now. Can you talk about what might be some comforts to people who have lost everything?
That's a difficult question, actually. I don't know. You know, people, I think, yeah, for now, people have been affected like emotionally and like physically. And I think like the most basic needs, like human rights, you know, basic human rights that people can't access right now, I think it's a big problem. And then at least getting access to those like hygiene products, getting access to those, let's say, simple protection products, like heating, might feel people like going back to normal. I don't want to say normal, but at least like just getting out of this, you know, disaster mood, because, you know, you can't get out of this mood. Like if you can have access to food, if you can have access to, you know, let's say toilet products. So it makes it really difficult, I guess, for those people to just, you know, get through this.
You bring up human rights, and I'm wondering, could the American government and its allies around the world provide better aid to people affected by the earthquakes?
So, you know, I'm not an expert of this like field, kind of like this is just my like impression from media and my friends. So as far as I know, Turkey declared a fourth level emergency status. And then soon after that, I think we have over 100 countries tried to help in any way they could. I think U.S. is one of them. I remember one U.S. rescue team in the most affected, disrupted areas. I don't know much about like donations between or like the any sort of help between these two countries, but I know we also, among many other countries, we also have like U.S. rescue teams in Turkey. Yeah.
Emery Bozer is a graduate student at UW-Madison, a member of the Madison Association of Turkish Students. You can join in the conversation about the quakes and what comes up for you at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Emery, what are the best ways for people in Wisconsin to help?
I think one thing, if they are considering like donating financially, so as MATS, Madison Association of Turkish Students, we share the QR code for Turkish philanthropy fundraising. This is the money goes directly to nonprofit, institutions, and then go to most needed areas. If they consider donating like kind of items, I think they should be, you know, following us or either Twitter or Instagram just to see, you know, what is most needed. And we also have our like drop-off locations. We always have on-campus and off-campus drop-off locations. So we have we got support from like local cafe shops, you know, or like restaurants, some places, not only in Madison, but also like kind of neighboring places in Madison have their drop-off locations. You could just walk in and then drop your donation. So we at some interviews, we go and then just take those donations and then package, like doing the packing together and then send it to the Chicago. Yeah.
What do you hope people learn from the response to this tragedy?
So it is a very, very natural, you know, disaster. It could happen to like anyone, not just, you know, like earthquake is something all about like geography, and it is not that likely to have earthquake, let's say in Wisconsin. So it might be kind of hard to, you know, understand, you know, it's not something we get to, you know, experience in this area, but you could travel and you could be like just one of those people. I think it shows how, like, especially like the stories we hear from the area shows like how you know, natural disasters could catch anyone, and that we should be all prepared for it. And I think, donating or like, you know, just being there, supporting people is just one way to, you know, help people get through it.
I understand you'll be visiting Turkey later this spring. What do you hope to do while you're there?
So it's going to be a very short break actually for me and my wife. It's just it's just a regular visit to Turkey. So I don't know, time will show us. We are just planning to actually see our families for now. They both live in unaffected cities, but I also have like very many friends in those destructive areas. So depending on the, you know, situation, then we can just go to the area and then try to be of help as much as we can.
In our last few moments together, I just want to bring up politics for a moment, as President Erdogan has faced criticism for the crumbling buildings and for, you know, construction codes and things like that. Do you think that that is having an impact on the upcoming election?
That's a big issue right now. So, especially the Erdogan side, you know, is sort of trying to like postpone the elections, and then they try to make it, you know, like this is a natural disaster, and let's have the elections in later. But the thing is, from the, you know, public folks and like the opposition parties, is like it should be done, like as soon as possible, because this is also kind of part of a failure of like responsibilities, and we may need a change, and then that change might take care of what just happened.
Emory, thank you for joining us. Emory Bozer, doctoral student at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.